Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Opioid distributors and manufacturers this morning reached a tentative settlement in a landmark federal lawsuit set to go to trial today in Cleveland. We're talking about that today on our weekly reporter roundtable. Andy Chow is a reporter with the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Welcome.
Good morning.
And Daryl Rowland is public affairs editor at the Columbus Dispatch. Welcome.
Breaking news Monday.
And Jeremy Pelzer, politics reporter at Cleveland.com. Welcome.
Hey, great to be here as always.
We don't know a lot. Right now, this just happened, you know, less than an hour ago. Well, 1 a.m. I found out about it less than an hour ago. Gosh, these guys don't sleep much. What, if anything, is known about the settlement, Daryl Rowland?
Well, we'll all three try to cobble together what we know. The Wall Street Journal broke the story, and then the Associated Press confirmed it. We have a settlement of what appear to be the main plaintiffs in the main defendants in the opioid litigation up in Cleveland. Now, this just involves two defendants, Cuyahoga County, Summit County. This is widely viewed as a test case, if you will, a precedent for the much broader settlement that is to come. So whatever dollar figure these two counties get, it's just then a matter of how much we multiply it out with all the other folks who are standing in line with their litigation, how it's all divvied up, who ends up with the money. Aside from the attorneys, we know they're probably first in line. The local folks the folks involved in the settlement include a local drug distributor, Cardinal Health, also AmerisourceBergen, and McKesson. And those are the three biggies. There's one minor one that has not settled. Teva, the drug maker, is part of the settlement. Walgreens is still not. So in theory, we still have two defendants where the trial could go forward. But, you know, even as we're speaking here, I'm sure there's a lot of conversations going on in Cleveland about just what is going to happen. But, yeah, so the judges, the federal judge who was assigned all these cases, picked the two local cases, if you will, local to him, and says, let's see if we can get a settlement here and branch out from there, because they didn't necessarily want to a huge, long, complicated, and expensive trial.
Except that there is a value to having a trial, is there not, Jeremy Pelzer?
Well, there's still one defendant. Walgreens is still on that. They have not settled. And it's really unclear right now whether this trial will proceed with only one defendant. So I guess that's number one. This litigation's not over yet. And then second, I would say this is, as Daryl said, kind of a bellwether, a test case, and it kind of sets the tone, or at least the intention is to set the tone for all these other 2,000-odd opioid cases from around the country that this judge in Cleveland has been given.
There's also this idea out there, like Jeremy said, that there's more than 2,000 other municipalities out there that have cases pending in court. They want their lawsuit to go forward as well. And as is believed, if these companies are starting to settle with Cuyahoga County and Summit County, then maybe there will be some trickle-down settlements along the way. But there's also this other thing hanging out there where the judge in the case is mulling over, and I believe this is still the case, he's mulling over this idea of agreeing to some sort of formula where the companies would agree to a settlement among every municipality in the country. I think that's 30,000 plus local governments, because they say that this problem is so widespread, this epidemic is so widespread that it's hit every single local government in the country.
Well, don't the local governments, these political subdivisions that are involved, we keep talking about the distributors and the manufacturers, but what about the plaintiffs in these cases? Are they part of the settlement?
Well, sure. There's no settlement without both sides agreeing, of course. Yeah, now it would just be, again, the lead to at this juncture. And again, as Andy and Jeremy both said, this is the intent is, whether it's a formula, it's a precedent, whatever, basically, as Cuyahoga County and Summit County, whatever they get, this is to be a pattern for the rest of the settlements. Now, even beyond all those cases of local government consolidate in Cleveland, of course, we have separate litigation in a variety of places, including involving the state of Ohio in, I think it's Ross County and Madison County. Attorney General Dave Yost has been quite outspoken on Ohio should be like the lead plaintiff and decide on where the money goes from the state on down to ensure fairness from his perspective. He's not gotten very far with that legal argument.
So I think it's fair to say there's a little ambiguity as far as how much settlement each other municipality will get, how it'll get that way. But I believe because these companies have settled with Cuyahoga and Summit, that's an indicator that it will trickle down to the other, and not that these other municipalities are lower than Cuyahoga and Summit, but that it'll spread out to all the other plaintiffs in the case, that it signals that there will be a settlement throughout. And again, the ambiguity comes into how much would be owed to every plaintiff. Is there a formula in place? How will it be distributed? And again, you got to remember that State Attorney General Dave Yost is arguing that he wanted the state's case to go forward. Mm-hmm. The state has a different case in a different court, and he wanted that to go forward and sort of be the lead runner in this case against opioid companies or drug manufacturers, drug distributors, so that the state would be awarded the money, and then therefore the state can decide how that money is distributed out to the local governments. That hasn't happened. It seems like this local government case has still been leading the way forward so far.
Is there any value, I guess I'm going back to the same question I asked, in arguing and having a trial? And I mean, is it
People would argue
these stories and getting the complaints out there?
People would argue, well, yeah, when you have a settlement, you're not going to have these people on the stand. You're not going to be able to ask them and have their day in court, so to speak. And yeah, I would say for the people who are suing, the people who have been hurt by opioid abuse, a lot of them do want to see these CEOs take the stand and have to defend themselves.
I believe the argument against having that day in court and for just going for the settlement is that for most of these local governments, they already know the truth as to how these things happen. They already have a good sense of how the epidemic started and what are some of the best practices to avoid something like this in the future. And I think they would rather, because they know how it started, they'd rather just take the money to be able to address the situation. That
they don't need to
now
make a point.
Exactly. I think that would be the argument for just settling.
Probably the frustrating part for those who've been touched very personally by this is that typically in lawsuit settlements, there is no admission of wrongdoing. That is actually part of the the settlement. It's like, yeah, I'm giving you a bazillion dollars, but don't take that to mean I'm admitting I've done anything at all wrong. And the plaintiffs will sign off on that if they want the money. So for those wanting a pound of flesh through the civil proceedings, you know, a pound of flesh being, okay, CEO, sit up there and admit what you did was wrong, what you did affected my loved ones in a very negative way. That, you know, they'll be denied that.
But this is an ongoing epidemic. There are people who are in need of treatment right now. There are people who are in need of services right now. And I think there are local governments out there who will just take that money right now to be able to use it for those services more immediately.
And just to avoid confusion, this is not a criminal trial. This
right.
is a civil trial. So it's not like they got out of jail time or anything because of this is
right.
between two parties suing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I would say that this money is needed, though. I mean, not only for drug treatment and medical care and just all these costs that these counties have had to bear, but also going forward, prevention programs, the burden that they've had to face has been huge. And $260 million for just three, four companies, that gives you an idea of how much money these counties have had to spend. Mm-hmm.
I thought it was going to be in the billion-dollar range.
But this is just two counties.
This is just two counties, right?
Yeah, we're talking about, what, $18 billion or something like that was tossed
around
last
week. $18 billion over 18 years.
So, yeah, something like that.
Yeah,
like I say, if you multiply this out,
gotcha.
And I don't know if they're doing this per capita, per drug death. I mean, who knows if there is a formula here, but just multiply this out.
Well, 400,000 people have died in the U.S. from overdoses of legal and illegal opioids since 1999. That's according to federal mm-hmm. data. Mm-hmm. That's a lot of people.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think if you look at I might be getting this wrong, but I think it was the Oklahoma case that had Johnson & Johnson settle. And that number, I think, was in the
billions.
Yeah.
And that's because it's a much bigger, I think it's for the whole state. And so Daryl's right. When you multiply this for every municipality that should get in on this at some point, it will be a much larger number.
Anybody know the impact on the likes of Cardinal Health going through this? Is there any sense that anyone goes out of business?
Cardinal Health is a Fortune 100 company.
I think
they're able to
shoulder this burden. Pocket change.
Probably. It's not pocket change for any company, but comparatively, it's not going to break the bank for them.
When you look at the profits that they're making, this would take a huge chunk out of what they've been making, but I think they'd still be able to keep afloat throughout to the end of it. But so I don't. When it comes to Cardinal Health, no, I don't think it's going to be a large enough blow to put it out of business.
And when you started saying this is an ongoing thing, what I thought you were getting at, besides the crisis and the opioid crisis itself, was this doesn't necessarily mark the end of litigation.
This is the beginning.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. This is not a resolution by any means. This is just the first.
I think that they're trying to make them all go away, I would assume would be their goal. So, yeah, this is the first step. Multiply this out by all the plaintiffs in this current case. Then I guess somehow you have to deal with the folks, as we said, like the state of Ohio, who have separate litigation. And I'm sure many other jurisdictions have separate litigation that have not been consolidated in Cleveland Federal Court. How you make everyone whole and everyone happy, probably the latter will never be accomplished, but it's going to be a lot of dollars flowing out here. And then the question will be, you got a big pot of money sitting in government. Who gets it? How's it going to be split up? Is there going to be pressure to use it for, we got these drug problems, but, we got this big need over here, too. Just like the tobacco settlement. Started out, going great guns.
Well, then they sold it off.
Yeah, and it was used, arguably for another good purpose to build a whole lot of school buildings in the state of Ohio, but not the purpose of the settlement. And over the years, your anti-tobacco advocates will point out that effort went down, down, down. And guess what? Ohio's smoking rate went up, up, and up.
And we talked to Governor Mike DeWine about this, I think, several times. Jeremy, I know you were there for one of them, where we talked to the governor about how will you protect this money in the future to say, this is the money we have, this is what we want to spend it towards, and we're not going to let the legislature grab it and put it towards something else that we don't want it to go towards. And I believe he said that he wants to create a certain position within the administration to oversee this money and to make sure that it goes towards treatment. Yes, a little bit would go towards education, but a lot of it would go towards treatment and bigger prevention.
And this, keep in mind, this is the state money from the state lawsuit, not this Cuyahoga and Summit
At the local level, they have a lot of other bills to pay.
They do.
Right.
They have a lot of other bills to pay. Well, we will continue our weekly reporter roundtable. With us today, Daryl Rowland of the Columbus Dispatch, Jeremy Pelzer of Cleveland.com, and Andy Chow of Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
How do you turn what you love into a career? On season 2 of the Rivet podcast from WOSU, hear firsthand from students translating their interests into jobs without college. Listen to This American Graduate Project as we highlight the next generation of workers in the state's top industries of agriculture, insurance, and healthcare. Support for the Rivet podcast series comes from COSI. Subscribe now at wosu.org/rivet, on the WOSU mobile app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us, politics reporter at Cleveland.com, Jeremy Pelzer, public affairs editor at the Columbus Dispatch, Daryl Rowland, and Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter Andy Chow. Today is the deadline, this afternoon sometime, for Ohioans against corporate bailouts to submit 260,000 plus, I think, valid signatures to put the question of the nuclear bailout law on the 2020 ballot. Listeners, I'm going to do a whole hour on this tomorrow. But for now, once again, more, you know, an 11th hour conversation here. If Ohio's Against Corporate Bailouts meets the criteria, gets 260,000, well, I guess, all right, what's going to happen? Daryl Rowland, they're on a deadline. They say it's close. What if it's
– Well, what happened? Let's just real quick do the big picture.
Yeah.
The what we generically call the nuclear bailout, House Bill 6, was passed by the legislature, signed by the governor in mid-July. The opponents of that say we don't like that law, so they're taking advantage of a statute that allows a referendum. A referendum basically gives you 3 months to collect enough signatures, which is specified in the law as a certain percentage, I think, of the vote the governor got.
44 counties.
Yeah, 44, half the Ohio counties, and 260,000 and change valid signatures of Ohio registered voters. Today is the deadline, and actually, and I think they probably have till midnight if you want to go legally.
Okay.
So somebody, Frank LaRose's office, I don't know if they'll be, you know, up burning the oil at 11:59 p.m. or not. So that's the huge question. Do they have enough? And the thing is, those of you who've been familiar with these petition efforts, you can't just turn in the minimum, of course, because there's no way every signature is valid. I've heard some folks say you have to turn in almost twice as many because so many are not valid signatures of Ohio registered voters. They get thrown out. So you need the minimum plus X. So we'll see today what that is. Now, what happens next is these go to the various county boards of elections to see if they are signatures of valid.
They validate them locally.
Yes. For all the 88 counties or however many they have signatures from. And then we have a number. And if they've made the ballot, probably have some more court fights, but they've made the ballot then. Not again this year, of course, November of next year. If they have fallen short, then starting at that point, they have 10 days, a cure period or whatever, to add on to that total to try to get to the minimum.
And they get that grace period because they've handed in enough signatures to show good
faith. No, it's just if you don't have enough signatures, you get another 10 days to get it.
Yeah, the same goes for a ballot initiative. If you try to get an issue on the ballot and you turn in your signatures at the beginning of July, they count up those potential signatures. If they say, hey, you're about this many short, you have 10 days to go get the rest.
Okay.
And I think it's more of a sign of, yeah, you tried to get these signatures. We have found that you did not get what you thought you had gotten. So here's some time to make up for it. But they cannot be collecting signatures at this time. They have to wait until the Secretary of State's office tells them that they have fallen short.
And that is a change. We were talking during the break. That is a change in the law where, frankly, the legislature, with the support of the governor, made it harder to put these issues on the ballot. Previously, you could keep on collecting signatures. You didn't have to wait for the certification and then the 10 days. You could collect signatures like from whenever you turn them in today, clear to the certification, then 10 more days. Mm-hmm. And, you know, some issues in the past have come fairly close. That period's been key. So they've taken out this interim while the county boards are certifying the signatures. It's like a dead period, if you will.
And again, the issue in question here is, will voters next November see a potential referendum on HB 6? This is a bill that essentially bails out Ohio's two nuclear plants. It offers subsidies to two coal plants. It rolls back renewable energy standards, and it eliminates energy efficiency standards. So there's a lot of things at play here. And what we saw is, I mean, this has been, as everybody knows here, this has been a saga for months now.
Insane. and unprecedented.
And what something that's been piquing a lot of interest here is, I think Andrew Tobias from Cleveland.com wrote an intense preemptive campaign, because this isn't really even a campaign for the referendum. It's just to collect signatures. Yet there have been commercials and ads and mailers sent out. But what we've seen in the past couple of weeks, especially the last 2 weeks, the group that wants to get this issue on the ballot at first they were basically sort of leaning on paid petitioners, leaning on trying to get people out there and paying for people to just get out there and collect the
it's
votes.
It's the most efficient way.
Right. And so lately there was sort of a turn where there was a bigger grassroots effort. There was a clamoring out there of people who wanted to jump into this and to help out. I know I've gotten a lot of emails from people who said, hey, I've heard your story and I want to jump in and help in some way. And I'm like, oh, I'm not really the person to
not running the show.
Yeah, I'm not running the show here. But so in the past 2 weeks, we saw more of an emphasis of a grassroots effort here. And I think that created a lot more momentum where more and more people started to get involved saying, oh, I'm ready to get in on this. And I think if there was some hesitation there because they were being met by somebody they didn't know on the street corner, but now all of a sudden somebody who's part of their environmental local group saying on Facebook, hey, come to this bar, come to this restaurant, and we're going to have signatures, that got a lot more interest of and people involved.
And they had to do this, Jeremy Pelzer, because the opponents, the people who don't, I guess the nuclear.
The pro-nuclear bailout.
The pro-nuclear bailout people.
Anti-referendum.
Pro-nuclear bailout don't even want it to get on the ballot. And so what they've done is this is preemptive campaign. They've used some really amazing, startling tactics.
It's unprecedented. Like on Friday, the Ohio Attorney General put out 27 different complaints they had received. Now, they're mostly unverified complaints, but they include things like these petition blockers would chase petition gatherers for miles in a car. They would be taking photos. They would literally surround the petition gatherer and anyone who tried to sign. They would sometimes literally dive in front of passersby to keep them from.
How can that be legal?
As long as you're. It's free speech.
That's what people have been asking me. How can this be legal?
I believe the
it's intimidation.
The legal line is crossed when there's physical contact with people. I think a lot of it has to do with speech. So a lot of it is yelling, screaming, forming a human barrier where the decline to sign.
What
folks,
if they did that for people trying to go to vote?
Yeah, that's it. You make up a really good
point. I mean,
I'm
kind of startled that this is considered.
Which is why you can't be within, 100 yards or 100
right.
feet of a polling
they
place.
They have those kinds of rules for voting. Isn't it?
There's
likewise?
No rules because we've never had this before. Until now, we haven't had a problem like this to solve because no one has taken these aggressive tactics before.
Attorney General Dave Yost has brought up that point, Anne, where he likened it to people. What if people were standing in front of a ballot box and stopping you from voicing your Democratic voice that way? We'd have a huge problem with it. So this has been an issue that's been brought up, and I believe there are people who are wondering if there should be some sort of legislative action taken in response to it.
Would that be a constitutional issue, Darrell Rowland? No, it wouldn't be. It's in state law, right?
Well, as my colleagues have mentioned, you know, you do have free speech issues. If I'm out circulating a petition, you would have the freedom to come and try to talk people out of signing that. Now, of course, we have video proof that much more than that is happening. We've had testimony. There's been people paid off or bought out, if you will, to subvert this petition effort. We've had a counter petition effort that are what I call fake petitions.
Informal. It's not.
Well, it's legally meaningless. All sorts of subterfuge. I think there are. It's almost a guarantee that this will at least get discussed in the legislature, whether they can thread that needle to satisfy free speech concerns and also say we don't want these people intimidated. I know, Attorney General Yost is looking into all of this. So it's an intriguing question, as Jeremy well says. You know, we've never been down this road before in Ohio, so these kinds of questions really haven't been asked.
What's interesting about this, too, is this isn't a Republican versus Democrat issue. Both campaigns are being led by Republicans.
Right.
On one side, it's just this motley crew, strange bedfellows, whatever you want to say, organization, the pro-referendum folks. It's these natural gas folks, these small government groups, environmental organizations, as Andy said. These are kind of a strange group collection of people who don't normally work together. And on the other hand, you have like First Energy Solutions. You have the locals from the people who live around the power plants. You have folks like that. Mike DeWine is in support of it.
Union organizations.
A number of union organizations.
AFL-CIO put a...
So, yeah.
Well, and this had Democratic support in the
legislature.
Otherwise, it wouldn't have gotten passed.
Mm-hmm. Mainly for the sake of the workers. We haven't brought up one point that is important, although this referendum, even if it qualifies, will not be voted on next year. The spokespeople in favor of the bailout say, if this qualifies for the ballot, those plants will start the process to shut down.
Mm. That's what they've...
That's what they say.
And that's what they've said before. Mm-hmm.
Well, we've heard this before. We heard it, you know, if you don't pass this budget amendment, this is part of the budget, by the end of June, we're going to start the shutdown process. Well, end of June came, wasn't passed, no shutdown. However, within, 17 days, they did get it passed. You know, now there would be no bailout money for a year plus. If this is certified.
But there wasn't going to be bailout money coming to the nuclear plants until 2021
anyway. Right.
So there's just a lot of – and the claim that Daryl brought up that First Energy Solutions has made, I mean, it could be correct that they could start the process of shutting down. Now, then you have to ask yourself, what is the process of shutting down? Does that mean filing paperwork? Does that mean physically shutting down things? We don't know. I think that if this does make it to the ballot, then that would be the sort of the negotiation chip, the bargaining chip that hovers around like, oh, we're about to close this plant. And you never really know what that actually means or if that's actually true or not.
Well, we'd have a year to know if I don't know if they say we're going to. Well, I don't think First Energy Solutions itself has said they're going to shut it down, although it's been implied. Their spokespeople for their cause.
Right. From the dark money groups.
But if that is certified, say, in early November and they go for a year without starting the shutdown process, I think a lot of people say that's a bluff. Now, as far on, you know, I guess in defense of a business, of a company, it's like even if that money's not going to flow till later, at least they would have the surety that finance would be coming because. Mm-hmm. You know, it's tough financially to operate a nuclear power plant. So without that cash flow, you got to buy fuel rods. They're custom made, things like that. Mm-hmm. So they wanted the assurance of that cash flow, even though they weren't going to get a dollar, you know, till a little bit down the road. They know it assured it was coming.
And we should also add another chapter of this whole saga is that First Energy Solutions is currently in bankruptcy court right now.
Not anymore. They reached a deal.
Oh, they reached a deal.
Reached a deal last week.
Okay, then never mind. Okay, yeah. So
they are, they're past it. But, I mean,
they're,
either
they're past
way,
it now. Right, okay, so what they want is
they
for these.
They have a bankruptcy plan.
So what they want is for these subsidies to be able to guarantee any new investors that these subsidies are going to flow in. So to Daryl's point, there's trying to find a surety in financial planning that there will be money there on the back end.
Something that we haven't talked about, maybe we haven't, I just missed it, that they have spent a lot of money that people collecting signatures, like this is their allegations, they're collecting signatures to block the bailout, to get it on the ballot, were offered cash or plane tickets to stop. Is that legal?
It's illegal to buy signatures.
Okay.
So if you collect signatures and I'll say, hey, I'll buy them to make sure and that they don't
I can
get
just
turned in,
burn them. Okay.
That is illegal.
Okay.
To recruit you to say, hey, why don't you come work for me and work for, as Daryl said, my fake petition, that's legal.
Here's where it gets gray to me, though, Anne. So let's say that you've been collecting signatures for the referendum, and I pay you to stop collecting signatures. So you have a stack full of signatures, and I say, stop collecting signatures and just walk away. If you leave that stack on the table and never turn them in, then did I pay for those signatures? They never got
and we don't know if that's actually happened.
Correct, yeah. But I think that's the question is,
been allegations that that's happened.
There are federal court affidavits to that effect.
Yeah, okay. And so affidavits, are you paying for signatures or are you paying for the person to leave? And if
or
the
both.
Result of
yeah.
that person to leave is that the signatures never get delivered, then aren't you paying for the signatures?
Attorney General Dave Yost is investigating these claims now?
Yes.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
And Dark money groups that support the bailout have spent millions on advertisements claiming a Chinese conspiracy, that they're collecting data. Now, of course, we know, we've said it many times, and I'll say it again, anything that they're collecting on a petition is what would be public record anyways. It's just this, if you're a registered voter, that's what they're validating is, are you a registered voter? And, you know, that kind of stuff. And that's already public record. The Chinese have got it, people. It's all over. But it's too late. But has that had, do we know if it's made a difference?
Gene Pierce said overall, he's the head of the, pro-referendum side. Yeah. He said all this stuff combined has definitely had an impact. It's made it really hard. He said it's tilted the playing field. It's and they wouldn't spend this money and they wouldn't do this effort for this long if it wasn't effective. And it absolutely has been effective.
You know, anecdotally, when I run into people who want to sign the referendum, they say, oh, I heard that commercial and it was just so despicable that I had to actually sign it. But it's the people we haven't talked to. Yeah. It's the people who you never know if they would have signed something or not that those ads are targeted towards to begin with. And I think you also have to remember that, I believe, somebody can correct me if I'm wrong, the referendum has to gather signatures from 44 Ohio counties.
Right.
So it's not just the urban counties. It's not just the big counties. It's these more rural counties. And you have to ask yourself, is that a stronger message in some of these more rural counties where they do worry about trade issues? They do have some there's a stigma around the Chinese government, maybe more in those counties too. So you have to ask yourself if that's maybe where those ads are targeted towards.
I mean, the purpose of these ads, it's not just to convince people, I don't like this issue. It's to make them just so fed up with the system that they're just like, I don't know, I can't sort through all this, so I'm just not going to sign anything. Yeah. And I'm just going to tune out.
Yeah, and I'm like Andy. I've just anecdotally, which is, you know, nothing's close to statistically relevant, but just anecdotally, people, friends, family members know what I do for a living. So they've asked me personally, mm-hmm. you know, what is it with all this back and forth and who's right and who's wrong and all that? And by the same token, I've, like Andy and I probably Jeremy too, whenever we write stories like this, I will have, my colleague Randy Ludlow has, people say, where can we get mm-hmm. to these petitions? Because I'm so upset by these foolish, grossly untrue ads, lies, quite frankly, that I want to sign my name to the other side to countervail that.
But if you call up Ohioans Against Corporate Bailouts, they're not just going to give it to you over the phone where the petitions are being signed or circulated, because you could easily be one of the opposition mm-hmm. trying to target them.
And so that was the strategy a week or two ago. But as I mentioned, that grassroots effort, mm-hmm. they started more publicly saying, we're having signing events. We're going to hold them in these places that are privately owned locations, so you can feel comfortable coming into our space, learning about the issue and signing it. So I was at Land Grant Brewery on Friday where people were set up in a room where, and then people came. I met people from Miami County, from Hocking County.
Really?
They were coming up to Land Grant to sign these petitions. It was a way to say, I know if you're interested in this, this is where we're going to be. You can go into a room where we can talk to you about the issue.
And the blockers can't go in there.
Because
it's private.
Because it's private. And okay. So the owners of these businesses said that they had the right to kick people out if those owners—
Did they have to do any of that?
Not that I saw. In fact, I didn't see—I don't know of anybody else—I didn't see any blockers out this weekend.
Are you rolling your eyes, Jeremy?
The fact that you have to drive from Miami County to Columbus to sign a petition— I mean, if that's what they've been reduced to, they're done. Mm-hmm. You know, like Hocking County, like if you have to drive up to Land Grant in Columbus, my goodness. Mm-hmm.
I got an email last night from somebody in Akron looking for a place to sign it.
Yeah, good point. I see what you're doing. Okay, what your points? All right. We have more to talk about. It's busy out there. So it's our weekly reporter roundtable. We're still with us, Daryl Roland, public affairs editor for the Columbus Dispatch, Jeremy Pelzer, politics reporter for Cleveland.com, and Andy Chow, reporter for the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It is our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us, Daryl Rowland of the Columbus Dispatch, Jeremy Pelzer of Cleveland.com, and Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. There is a bill. It's being dubbed the Ohio Fairness Act that would provide protection for employment, housing, and public accommodations for people who identify as something along the LGBTQ continuum. And the House's legislation has a Republican backer. What's the significance of this, Andy Chow? We know at the federal level there are questions.
So just to bring everybody up to speed, this is a bill that would add to the Ohio's anti-discrimination code. It would make sexual orientation and gender identity and gender expression protected classes. So we already have sex, age, race. Those are protected classes in the discrimination code, protecting you from housing discrimination, employment discrimination, and public accommodation. So people say that adding those new protected classes would be a huge step for LGBTQ rights. This is a bill that's been introduced every single session, and it's slowly but surely just picking up a little momentum here and there, whereas in past years it will just be introduced and then the sponsor of the bill would give testimony. Then a few years back it started to get some Republican support, where a Republican co-sponsor would say, hey, although I'm conservative, I believe that these should also be added into protected classes as well. Then 2 years ago, business groups started supporting it, saying this is good for Ohio's economy, and so hundreds of business groups started to jump on
traditionally
as well.
Republican,
right? And
the chamber, blah blah blah,
and traditionally a block of companies and groups that can have a lot of political sway at the state house too. So that was a big get for supporters of the Fairness Act. Now what you're seeing is, yes, the bill has already been introduced in the Senate by Senator Nikki Antonio, and that
Democrat.
Has a Democrat who also has a Republican co-sponsor, and now it's been introduced in the House. It got a couple of committee hearings in the Senate, which was a big deal because it was moving further than it had ever had before. And now it's going to be introduced in the House. And so I think what you have is these two bills that are trying to build up momentum for this cause. And then you have somebody like Representative Brett Hillier, who is a Republican, who I believe is a big supporter of Householder, the Speaker of the House.
He was pro Householder.
He was one of the first members. He was a newer member to say, I'm here for Householder. So I think that, again, he has this credibility among conservatives, is what I'm saying, on the right wing of it all. And so for him to also be a supporter of the bill and saying, listen, when it comes to being conservative, I believe that all people should have the right to employment, the right to housing. It's just another step towards possibly building momentum for this bill.
Is it possible, Daryl Rowland, that this might be the year? Because it's not the first time.
Right. Well, you know, Andy referred to Senator Antonio, who used to be Representative Antonio and had introduced it four straight sessions in the House as well. And, you know, got shot down each time, but yeah, a little bit of progress. It's all going to depend on leadership, like so many things, and probably more Larry Householder than anyone. He is really not given, I don't know, warm fuzzies out about this bill, or frankly about the the LGBTQ rights movement overall. You know, he called into questions the drag queen days at the library and things of that nature. So, but I'm not sure he's actually addressed this specifically. Governor DeWine has not been a fan. You know, he did issue an executive order to protect those in state employment at the beginning of the year, but said, that's enough. We don't necessarily need this statewide. So, again, two steps of movement have been taken. Will we get to the finish line or get this achieved in Ohio? Boy, that's a really tough question at this juncture.
It's worth saying that across all three branches of Ohio government, there's only one place that doesn't give state employees or public employees LGBT protections in employment, and that's the Ohio House of Representatives.
Which was a departure from previous policy.
I believe. Yes,
yeah,
that's correct.
They removed language that did previously.
And so if that's any indication, it's going to be a really tough sell.
Right.
The argument from Speaker Householder was that having that in the handbook would not be it would not match what state law is. This bill would change state law to match that with the handbooks of other branches of government.
Yeah, it's kind of disingenuous. It's like, well, it doesn't match state law. Well, you haven't. There's been a bill to change state law, and they haven't imposed
it. And it doesn't stop the governor or the Senate.
Right. It didn't stop the governor or the Senate or the
Governor DeWine is putting opioid disposal bags in the hands of workers' compensation recipients. What's going on with that? Who knows?
So these are bags. So if you're prescribed pills and you for a certain injury, and then you are able to overcome the pain of that injury without using the pills, all of a sudden you're left with this bottle in your house. And some people sort of dread taking the extra two or three steps to go about disposing it, because you're not supposed to just throw it in the trash. Maybe you go back to your doctor and maybe you just don't find the time. So it just sits in your medicine cabinet. People who have been fighting the opioid epidemic on all sorts of fronts say that this is just another issue when it comes to allowing people to have access to these pills that shouldn't have those pills. Just the idea of them sitting in your medicine cabinet is not a great one. So if you give these bags along with the pills to people who are trying to overcome injuries, then it's a way to safely dispose of the pills in a quicker fashion. That way you're avoiding the problem of having these pills just sitting in a medicine cabinet.
Because the bags destroy the opioids. There's these substances in the bags that render the pills unusable.
Yeah, you shake it up. And
there, the idea is this will be deployed to every retail pharmacy in the state that dispenses opioids. And it's for first-time people who get prescriptions. So the first time you get an opioid prescription, you'll get a bag with this.
I wanted to talk about Dayton Mayor Nan Whaley's decision to jump on board with the group that is working on a ballot issue on statewide, or to get a statewide vote on universal background checks. She was also at the side of the governor when he put his proposal out there, expand the pink slip law, and also, what he put out there a few weeks ago. Mm-hmm. But the day after the debate last week, she kind of came out in full force. What's going on?
Well, as she said at the time, I like what the governor's done, but we need to go further. Mm-hmm. And the governor's original plan called for universal background checks. He eased up on it. Now he's calling for basically voluntary background checks. Mm-hmm. And she's saying, no, well, I'll support what the governor says, and that's great, but we need to go further. Now it provides a bit of a boost to them and to the initiated statute. What I don't understand is they're going for an initiated statute, which means they present it to the legislature, and then the legislature probably won't pass it. But then if you gather enough signatures, it becomes a law. But then it's a law. It's not a constitutional amendment.
The next General Assembly can just come in and repeal it. Usually what it does is it forces the Ohio General Assembly to do something.
And there's a campaign strategy here where in the past, if somebody tries to go for a constitutional amendment, the main argument against a constitutional amendment during campaign season is, do you really want to change the Ohio Constitution just for this one thing? And so this is sort of the strategy of, well, okay, we hear you, so we'll just go about changing the revised code instead. And there's another argument during campaign season of this ballot issue is trying to overstep the legislature. Going this route would say, no, we've tried to get the legislature to vote on it. And if they have 4 months, and if they refuse to do anything about it, then it would become a ballot issue. So those would be two things that a campaign for this issue would have going for them, is that they could sidestep some of those opponent attacks.
Governor DeWine, when he introduced his plan, said that there were three reasons why. And one of them was that it was passable, that it could be enacted. And yet, once again, Speaker Householder has said, not so great. So could this be a tipping point, or could this be the straw that breaks the camel's back and gets the House to act and move on the governor's proposal or not?
I don't think the timing's right.
Okay. Why? How so?
Well, by the time the initiated statute has enough signature, I mean, unless you're talking into like next year or whatever.
Okay.
because they have several months to act.
Till December, I think.
The end of December.
Yeah.
Okay. I don't know. We'll see. I'm not sure they really marry up that much. I'm not sure having because we're talking about a constitutional amendment versus initiate statute. Initiate statute just says I want circulate petitions to get a new law here. In Ohio, you have to do first round, get your signatures, then give the legislature a shot to do it. If they don't, you can get that same number of signatures, put
Again,
it on the ballot.
That's right. Okay, it's a two-step process. That's right.
So, yeah. But those total signatures are less, significantly less than it would be to amend the Constitution. So their strategy that way, this will be easier to get. Now, background checks are supported, if you believe any poll, Fox, whatever, by roughly 90% of people and huge percentages of Republicans, gun owners, NRA members, you name it. By any measure, this should not be a controversial issue. But it is in Ohio.
Yeah, this bill would make it so that anybody selling a firearm to somebody else has to require a background check unless it's between family members. If you want to give your child a gun or something like that of age, if you want to give your family member a gun, then you would be exempted from this. But what we're talking about here is personal transfers, basically. So if there are people who like selling guns online, that they make it sort of like a side business for themselves, personal transfers. Some of those people do require background checks. Some of them could be federally licensed dealers, but a lot of the personal transfers are just people who are selling guns to somebody else, and therefore you can skip a background check.
So there's two reasons for the opposition here. One is the policy reason, which is, hey, if I'm going to sell you a gun and we're just doing it between ourselves, how is the government going to know that I actually did a background check on you? Like, how do you prove that? And so how do you enforce that? That's a reasonable thing. The second thing is political. There's a lot of talk that perhaps Larry Householder might be interested in running for governor in the next couple terms. I know.
No.
So you have to wonder if that fits into is he going to give DeWine a win on this? That you have to wonder that, too.
Okay.
A lot of Householder support is from gun rights groups.
Yes.
His platform was hugely based on the Second Amendment, and one of his campaign commercials has him, I think, shooting a TV with a shotgun.
Yeah, I don't know why he picked a TV. Maybe a couch. I don't know.
It doesn't explode the same
way,
I guess.
That's true. I don't know. Okay. So, you know, I guess this is a wait and see thing. We'll know by the end of December. I'm wondering, though, did the Dayton episode, the tragedy in Dayton, 9 people killed in 32 seconds by one gunman, others wounded, it certainly energized Nan Whaley. Mayors have been often at the forefront of this. I'm wondering if the dynamic is going to change now, because I think mayors, well, look at Pete Buttigieg. You know, mayors are getting a little leg up these days.
A lot of mayors have endorsed.
Yes.
Mayor Lima, John Cranley in Cincinnati, Nan Whaley herself has endorsed Mayor Pete.
Mayor Mern is a Republican from Findlay. She also endorses these types of measures as well. The Ohio Mayors Alliance is basically pushing for something that is similar to the red flag law and expanded background checks. And that's a lot of those mayors are Republicans who say that they are on the ground looking at their constituents every day. And from what they're hearing, that their constituents, even from more conservative places, want these measures.
Well, we shall see. Real quick, we only have about 30 seconds, but House Dems are proposing unemployment benefits for striking workers. Is this just something you put on your campaign lit? Because it sounds like there's not a snowball's chance.
Given the state of how unable the legislature has been to reform the unemployment benefit system at all, which is basically insolvent, I see very little chance this will pass.
Okay. All right.
It
well,
was a gesture to striking members, GM employees.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Joe Rowland, thanks so much for joining us today.
Good to be here, as always, Ann.
Joe Rowland, public affairs editor for the Columbus Dispatch. And Jeremy Pelzer, thanks to you.
Thank you.
Jeremy Pelzer, Cleveland.com politics reporter. And Andy Chow, thanks again.
Thanks, Ann.
Andy Chow is an Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter. And that's it for our weekly reporter roundtable. Thanks so much for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.